Hi, I'm Gary Bauerman, and this is a special extra edition of the Southeast Asia Travel Show. This week, Hannah and I participated in an online webinar debate with Brett Henry from MG Group. We set out the landscape for travel and tourism in Southeast Asia in 2021 and debated some challenging issues for travelers and travel brands around the region. We hope you enjoy this extra show.
Hey, good afternoon. It's Brett Henry, President Director at MG Group. Happy 2021 to everyone out there. Really excited to kick off the first MG Insights of 2021. And you know, it's really a struggle for us during this crisis to find thought leadership, to find guidance in terms of this rapidly changing landscape. So I'm really happy to welcome to the show today two of who I think are the top thought leaders as it relates to what's happening at the Southeast Asia travel landscape level. Please welcome to the show, Hannah Pearson and Gary Bauerman.
Hey guys.
Gary, welcome.
Hey, good afternoon.
Hey guys, thanks for joining today. Really excited to have a conversation with you. It's been a crazy, crazy ride. I've spent time talking to both of you over the last, 9 or 10 months since the crisis started individually. This is our first time with the three of us talking together. So looking forward to the conversation. You know, and this platform is all about us trying to provide insights for travel leaders around the region to help them, you know, both understand what's happening at both the micro, the market and macro levels, as well as get suggestions and guidance on actionable insights. So I think that's what we plan to kind of walk through today. We're basically going to have three sections of the discussion. We're going to start out, you know, talking about briefly, you know, what are some of the key learnings and insights we have from thinking about what's happened to date in this kind of crisis situation. So mainly reflecting on 2020. Then we'll move into a quick walkthrough of what's the current status in each of the top six markets across Southeast Asia. You know, what's happening now and what do we expect for 2021 for each of those six markets. And then we'll finish up with a section on, you know, our top three areas of focus or insights that we want to pass on to you as kind of actionable insights for 2021. Gary, Hannah, sound good for an agenda?
Let's go.
Sounds great. Yeah. Thanks, Brett.
All right, great. So we'll kick off just talking about 2020 and what, you know, kind of some of our key learnings were from last year. And when I think about it, kind of one of the first areas that I think I said, and I definitely remember Hannah and I talking about is, hey, this is going to be a long journey. You better prepare for the long haul. And one thing I realize now is I said prepare for the long haul. I think I said, hey, this is survival of the fittest. This is Darwinism. You know, whoever can survive the longest is going to be the winner. So we said that. But I don't know that I took all the actions I would really take if I knew where I would be today in January 2021. So certainly one insight for me that I'd love to talk about with you guys is, man, long haul, when we said it, it meant long haul.
It did, didn't it? I think I agree. I think we talked back in March or April, ages ago, and we said long haul. And, you know, deep down, you still thought, January 2021, everything's going to be back to normal. And we're in almost mid-January, right? And there's still no light. Actually, Southeast Asia things seem to be getting worse.
we'll talk about each market later, but it seems like in a lot of the markets in the region, we're actually in a more dire position than we were in, you know, February, March, April of last year.
Yeah, certainly. I think so.
But I think the interesting aspect of that as well is we are generally in a worse position in some of the markets, but some of those markets have peaked and troughed. I mean, in our country where we live, Malaysia, if you go back 3 months, we were in a very clear position. It was very well, it was under control, probably the same as Myanmar, you know, that both countries at that point had it under control, but then lost control quite rapidly, the same as Thailand as well. So it's this dynamic shifts, these peaks and troughs, which are so. Well, they impact absolutely every aspect of the economy, but travel and tourism particularly. You know, you've seen domestic tourism opens up, shuts down, closes down a bit, opens up again, shuts down again. You know, there's no continuity. And that's very, very difficult for the whole industry to deal with. However much you plan ahead, you know, this virus just beats us all.
What are we seeing in terms of the overall kind of economic picture in the region? I know a lot of people talk about, for example, Thailand and no inbound international, and it really hurting the economy. Are we actually seeing that play out in 20? Did we see that play out in 2020 at the macroeconomic level?
I think we saw the start of it. I think even if you listen to like the World Bank or the Asian Development Bank or the IMF, you know, they're all saying that 2021, the impact this year is going to be knock on. It's going to actually be cumulative. And so what we saw at the back end of last year, you know, we did see a lot of businesses struggling. We did see a lot of companies that were shelving jobs, airlines, resorts, you know, everything across the tourism industry. But this year, I think it's going to become much more structural. So it's a much, much bigger economic issue for governments. You know, a lot of governments in our region handed out stimulus packages last year, but they had to borrow a lot of money to do that. They won't be able to do that this year. It's simply not possible. The borrowing requirements are so high. Here in Malaysia, I think borrowing is at something like 75-76% of GDP. And that's pretty much unsustainable. So this year, you know, how do economies grow is going to be the biggest issue. And I think, I mean, we've said this on the podcast several times. We're living in a region of at least two or perhaps even three speeds. But I think the region will definitely be looking to Singapore and to Vietnam for fast track growth this year.
What does that mean when you say two or three speeds? So I know there's some probably joining that do listen to your podcast. And if you don't, you guys should be connected there. But what do you mean when you say a region of two or three speeds as it relates to the current crisis?
I mean, it's really in terms of where they are in terms of handling the cases, and I think probably the economy too. So you've got countries like Singapore and Vietnam who are doing really well, who have handled it, who are leading the pack, I say. And then you've got the kind of middle, the middlers, people now like Malaysia. Thailand was one of the leaders. It slipped into the second tier, I think, of people struggling to contain it. And then you've got countries like Philippines and Indonesia, which are right behind, which are going to carry on struggling, I think, with the control of COVID for the foreseeable future.
Yeah, so I think it's exactly that division. But, you know, when you're looking at the way governments are looking at vaccines right now, you know, Singapore has a very small population. Vietnam at the moment it's not moving ahead too fast on vaccines. It's probably a bit slower than some of the other countries. But then you look at countries like Indonesia, Philippines, they've got to go full throttle on getting vaccines rolled out pretty quickly. So there's going to be different aspects of economic policy this year, I think, in different countries.
I think this GDP data is really interesting. I mean, if you look across the board, certainly a country like Vietnam, although not achieving what probably they had planned to, they're still in positive territory. Whereas looking through the other big markets, it's really a negative growth story as it relates to GDP. So that certainly may play into Vietnam's feeling on, and no rush to open. We're still in positive GDP growth territory, and we'll ride out 2020 and see what happens. If I look at the 2021 forecast, to be quite honest, you know, with all due respect to, is this from World Bank, I think?
Yeah.
But, you know, all due respect to World Bank, you guys are, I'm appreciative you're putting in the data, but it looks like, you know, this 2021 data was probably created like mid-year 2020. Like if they were writing this data today, would it say the same thing? Because it's just not what we're seeing in January, right?
Yeah, well, some of the countries, I think you look at Malaysia, you look at Thailand, you'd perhaps be a bit reticent about that. Vietnam, the government has actually said that they're targeting 6.5% GDP increase this year. So that tallies quite closely. But I think the Vietnamese economy is a little bit easier to predict. You know, they're very strong on exports. They're very strong on inbound foreign investment. Those will drive the country this year. They managed to keep the country afloat last year and avoid negative growth. But, you know, you look at where it was last year, around about 2%, 2.5%, and it wants to reach 6.5% this year. It's going to need to be some tourism economy, some tourism revenue in there to sustain that figure, I would think.
I think GDP is certainly an important leading indicator. I mean, there's a long-term historical correlation between a growth in a country's GDP and growth in travel. You know, so as businesses grow, more corporate travel is taking place. As businesses grow, more people are employed, more disposable income to spend on leisure travel. So there historically has been this straight line. So certainly as a leading indicator, I think it points to kind of this key learning from last year that long-term really means, you know, prepare for the long-term. Another really good leading indicator for people in the hotel business like MG is just looking at, especially for international, looking at flight volume traffic. Mm-hmm. You guys have any insights into what you're seeing in terms of flight data, both the region as well as globally?
Gary, you want to cover that one?
Okay, well, this is the international picture from IATA, which basically showing that, you know, moving 7-day averages, there's not a lot to look forward to throughout the year, really. It's starting quite flat. But in our region, yeah, it's really going to, you made a very good point there. You know, business travel was often overlooked. Domestic travel was often overlooked before the pandemic. And so was the value of domestic consumption. Now, these do play into airline flight routes. But, you know, all the countries in our region that don't have international flights, you look at Singapore, for example. I think in January last year, Singapore Changi Airport had about 5.2% growth year on year, just for January last year. It started the year really, really well. But then you look at what happened throughout the rest of the year. You know, it was down around 90 plus percent down on the year. It's going to be really difficult to get that back over a period of time.
Yeah, I mean, even if you look at domestic flights, things were a little bit better. So Thailand, you know, Thai Air Asia, at the beginning of December, before the second outbreak, Thai Air Asia was saying, oh, we're going to get back to our levels. We're going to exceed our 2019 levels by the end of December. Obviously, that didn't happen. But in Vietnam, domestic flights are getting there. They're getting back to the levels that they were back in 2019. But obviously, international is a complete disaster. It's a completely different story.
Absolutely. And I mean, we mentioned right at the beginning about these peaks and troughs. I mean, Malaysia is a really good example. We'll come on to Malaysia in a minute. You know, Malaysia, after the initial lockdown, so from about June onwards, there was quite strong growth in domestic flights. Then we had the second wave and that got capped. Then domestic travel was allowed over the Christmas and New Year period. So there was another peak wave. And now we're going into a state of emergency. That's all going to be capped off completely. So it's impossible for airlines and hotels to make any kind of planning when the trajectory is going like that all the time.
Yeah, let me move us to the kind of next key insight. That's a great wrap up of, you know, prepare for the long term. It's real. Make sure you're really doing it. Kind of moving on to kind of key learning or insight from 2020 is strong point that how important China is, and China just basically overnight between February and March evaporated, right? It's just there as the number one inbound market for almost every market in the region. And everybody who ran an airline or hotel or ground tour operator went to bed, you know, some night in February, and they woke up the next morning and that shit was just gone. And, you know, subtext, you know, all international flights over time eventually also gone. So I think this is really, I know everyone knew how important China was, but we really found out how important both China as well as international is, and how ill prepared the industry overall and governments were to respond to that.
Yeah, well, it was the timing as well. I mean, this happened right on the verge of Chinese New Year. So, you know, there was just this dramatic drop off at the point when most countries in our region were expecting a surge. You know, you do expect around 7 million outbound Chinese trips from China during that holiday. And it just didn't happen. And it was the speed of cancellations. And I think, like you said, there was a sudden realization that the Chinese market wasn't just going to disappear for 2 weeks, 2 months, or even 3 or 4 months. This was a long haul issue. And for countries like, you know, Thailand, you know, last year they had 10 or 11 million arrivals from China. It's about more than a quarter of their inbound total for a year. You know, it's hugely reliant. And as you mentioned, every other market in the region also was very, very reliant on regular flow throughout the year, not just at Chinese New Year, but in October, but also across the year to fill those airline seats and to fill those hotel beds.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at this slide, you can see the growth, right? So from 2010, maybe this wouldn't have been such a massive issue if this had happened in 2010 in terms of the impact. It would have had an impact, but not such a big one so fast. But 2019, you know, Myanmar, China accounted for 39% of all inbound arrivals. So it's a huge reliance on it. And I think that, you know, don't put all your eggs in one basket was never truer, I think, by January, February time last year.
I think related to this point, a topic that we've talked about that I think is useful to throw out here for all, especially for kind of travel industry leaders to understand and think about what's the real impact of, is we've really learned that many governments in the region had very little understanding of the travel industry and how it works. And as they tried to propose the various solutions to or potential, you know, ways that we might begin to restart travel, became more and more clear that there's just a real lack of knowledge and understanding of the complexity of the travel industry and business.
100%. I mean, I couldn't agree with that anymore. I think that the complexity is the right word. You know, people travel across our region for many, many, many different reasons. You know, we tend to focus mostly on the leisure market, probably next on the business travel market, the domestic travel market. But, you know, there's a lot of economic migration across our region. A lot of people travel as students. A lot of people travel overseas. They're moving countries, visiting a family and friends. There's a lot of different reasons that people actually travel. And that really came to the fore last year because, as you say, governments just hadn't really understood the nuances of their visitor economies. Airlines and hotels, I think, did, but the governments who were the policymakers didn't. And when you lose, like, you know, that graphic shows there, when you lose such a big chunk of your main market, it's easy, I think, to say that countries and hotels and airlines over relied on China. But I don't think that's specifically fair, because it was the growth market. It was the market that everybody wanted to tap into. And in economics, that's what you do. You try and tap gold. You try and make the money when you can do so. You know, the problem was that there was no risk management planning for anything that would go wrong. You know, scientists had been saying, it's easy to say with hindsight, but they had been saying that a pandemic would disrupt travel and tourism to the nth degree, to a degree that we'd never seen before. And they'd been saying that for years. But because the 2010s was such an upward curve, pretty much throughout the whole decade, it was a growth curve. We discovered that tourism does tourism pretty well during a boom time. But when it condenses, when it contracts to this scale, it leaves everybody up the creek without a paddle. And I think it's quite hard to actually blame people for that, because it's not just the travel industry. It's pretty much all sectors.
Fair enough. Maybe moving on from this, a good transition from this idea around complexity of travel and governments not being prepared to respond to support the industry in crisis. And, you know, no one was prepared for this crisis, so I'm not trying to be overly critical on governments across the region. We love you. Maybe the third key learning I'll bring up from 2020, and this is my favorite of the insights from 2020. Last and favorite one is travel bubbles are like unicorn.
Yeah, I mean, I think Gary and I in our podcast last year seemed to have spent most of it talking about travel bubbles and the idea whether they're going to come or not come. And we got so close, didn't we? We got so close to the Singapore-Hong Kong air travel bubble. And then one day before it was meant to launch, it was cancelled. And that's the closest that we've got, you know, in a whole year to something substantial that, you know, would allow air travel bubble without quarantine, that would also cater for leisure tourism.
I mean, this came from Australia, New Zealand, right? Mm. I mean, how long ago was this announced? And then is there, everyone's talking about it, but no one's ever actually seen one, right?
I mean, well, I think it goes back to your point from a few minutes ago about how governments really didn't understand the nuances and the complexity of their travel industry. And also, as we were talking just before we came on air, you were talking about false idols and how, you know, travel bubble became this thing that everybody grasped onto, this way that we could somehow reboot travel, even to a limited degree. But the whole point about it was, you know, when it was initially discussed by New Zealand and Australia, it's back at the end of April. I mean, that's 9-10 months ago. It was quarantine-free travel between two countries that had pretty much at that point managed the virus quite well. Strong travel flows between the two countries anyway, quite strong cultural overlaps as well, but then they're neighboring countries. So it would have worked. But then, you know, that got taken into a different context where everybody wanted to do a travel bubble with everybody else, and it didn't really become realistic. If you look at what Singapore and Hong Kong actually tried to do, they tried to put pretty much every protocol in place to make it work while it was still quarantine free, but they were beaten by the virus. And, you know, I think it was a really valiant attempt, and we all really hoped that it would work just to get that movement going again. I think it's, we can't really lay any blame at Singapore or Hong Kong, because I think they tried absolutely everything. But some of the other ideas of travel bubbles we've seen in the region are frankly illogical.
Yeah, this morning, I don't know if people caught the news, we've even had Cambodia come out and say that they want to do an ASEAN-wide, ASEAN plus three, so including Japan, South Korea, and maybe China, travel bubble. It just seems right now that this is completely illogical. Sorry, Cambodia. But it is. I mean, you look at the state of some of these East Asian countries as well. Japan in a state of emergency. It's not going to happen. It's not going to happen an ASEAN one anytime soon, if ever.
I think there's definitely this sense of governments and media collaborating together to be seen to be doing something, to be trying to push the needle forward, when realistically it's not helping anybody. It's not helping the industry to plan, because the industry insiders themselves know the difficulties, the complexities of putting these deals together. And I think it's just a little bit, it's a false hope for sure.
I mean, it doesn't matter what you call it, travel bubble, green lane, I don't know, special visa type. They must have thought, somebody must have sincerely believed, like, hey, this is going to drive some volume. But I can't name any in Southeast Asia. Maybe in somewhere else in the world, there is a travel bubble that's working, that exists. But I can't name any. And also can't name any of these kind of business or government business green lanes that any travel supplier told me is materially contributing. So it seems like all of the efforts to get anything started to date have been troubled.
Yeah, I mean, Singapore announced that they have several regional, several reciprocal green lanes, and that has only generated about 2,500 pax. And I think they've had some of them in place since June or July last year, and it's had that few. And that's Singapore with all of their protocols and everything else in place, and even they've not managed to make it work. It's just stuck.
I think they had around 11 different green lanes.
Yeah, something.
Announced.
Yeah.
And good on them. I'm not criticizing them for trying. Good on them for trying. Keep trying.
Yeah, exactly. They've got to. Yes.
Okay. Let's move into talking about 2021. You know, so let's do a quick flyby for all of the top six markets. If you want to mention any of the others that are notable, we can as well. You know, just talking about, you know, what's the current status in each of the large Southeast Asian markets as it relates to travel, the crisis, COVID. As of today, and any other kind of key dynamics that you think are relevant to understand the current situation. So why don't we kick off, because both of you are in KL today, right?
Yeah,
and lots of news coming out of Malaysia. No better place to start than what's happening in Malaysia on Tuesday, the 12th, 2021.
Go on, Gary, you can give them a rundown.
Well, where do we start? I mean, we alluded to this in the preamble, but, you know, Malaysia has had these discernible peaks and troughs, but since September the 26th, when there was a state election in Sabah, and there was a lot of travel back and forth between East Malaysia and the peninsula, we have seen numbers rise quite fast. And through December, not just the number of cases, but the number of active cases, and also the number of deaths has risen. And it's put huge pressure on the healthcare system. You know, the Prime Minister spoke yesterday to the nation. He spoke again to the nation today. And he said that the healthcare system is really struggling. The ICU beds are full, and the number of cases is unmanageable. So yesterday he announced that there would be a movement control order, which is exactly the same as we had back in March last year, but only in six states, which would restrict movement initially for 2 weeks, but probably would go on a bit longer. And then today that was extended. We're now in a state of emergency until August the 1st. It's still not entirely clear what that means, how different that means to the MCO. There's also a great deal of political instability here as well.
Did you say August the 1st?
August the 1st, yeah.
Yeah.
There's a great deal of political instability, but obviously it's going to be a shutdown for domestic travel, which enjoyed a really strong week and a half over Christmas and New Year. I was up in Langkawi, a holiday island up in the north, and it was absolutely packed. I'm not sure I've ever seen Langkawi that busy as it was over the New Year holidays. But other cities, Penang, Malacca, they were reporting pretty good hotel numbers as well. But that's all come to a grinding halt. And at the moment, the uncertainty, you know, there's quite a degree of fear in Malaysia about the virus as well. So we're in a real situation of just not knowing what the future holds.
Yeah, I mean, and in terms of borders opening up, I wouldn't think that that's going to... at least while we're under recovery movement control order, that's not slated to happen till 31st of March. I would be very, very surprised if it happens on the 31st of March. So I think in terms of inbound, in terms of outbound, it's going to be pretty limited until perhaps even Q4, I think, for Malaysia this year.
So current, so just summarize, current status is lockdown as strong as it's ever been currently. Looking through first quarter, second quarter, going to be challenging. So as you think about what's the current outlook for 2021 for Malaysia?
Depends on vaccine rollouts. Some vaccines have been procured. So they have procured the Pfizer, I think the AstraZeneca. They're still trying to procure Chinese and Russian vaccines. That's the way the government is.
But I do want to talk about that topic. So people are really looking forward to vaccines to be something that can help restart the economy, travel economy in Malaysia. What are the chances of international in 2021?
Pretty low.
And what are your prospects for domestic for 2021?
I mean, that's the only place people can go, but they need to be lifting these interstate travel bans. Perhaps this MCO is going to get things back. I mean, and I hope it's going to get things back under control. And then people will be able to domestically travel again, but that's probably not going to happen. Maybe mid-February. So it's going to miss Chinese New Year.
Yeah. Well, the Prime Minister said yesterday to forget Chinese New Year. So that won't happen. I think this is shaken confidence. I mean, speaking to people today, you know, the fact they've gone into state of emergency, which is the first time since 1969, that has a big psychological impact. So people are aware now that the virus is as bad as they thought it was and probably even worse. So I think that will knock confidence as well. As Hannah says, you know, the last time we had a lockdown in March last year, it did work. It worked pretty well. It was very strictly controlled and it did bring the curve right down. So there is that opportunity, but you know, all you do with a lockdown is you just press pause. So, you know, you can bring it right down again, but then how do you prevent it going back up? And that's what Malaysia hasn't been able to do.
I think there are some shining stars in that theory, and there's also some people that have stumbled. And so I think we can skip over to Thailand. Thailand, you know, was doing relatively well and brought the numbers right down with the lockdown early on and kept them essentially virus-free other than imports that they discovered in quarantine. And life was largely normal, as in Vietnam, as in mainland China. But in the past few weeks, they're starting to see, you know, what's happened in other markets around the region. You know, hundreds of cases around most of the country now, and some form of restriction, even though they're saying it's not a lockdown. But it's fairly restricted movement of people around the country. So I think it's a good tie to, you know, long term, and be prepared for a really bumpy ride. No matter how good a position you think you might be in, you could be in a very different position 1 month from now.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, things change and they're so unstable that it's hard to plan. And I think that's what makes life even more difficult for tourism businesses. You know, they were looking forward to such a strong year end in Thailand. I think they were relying on really picking up 5 million more domestic travelers, and then gone. Where do you go from that? How do you build things up again? That's going to be the big challenge for Thailand this year.
I think so. And I think one of the things that Thailand, and particularly a lot of countries, Malaysia a little bit the same as well, is there's these different levels of bureaucracy that get imposed during these times. So you mentioned there are different rules in different states. If you actually just look down the Tourism Authority of Thailand website at how these are actually being rolled out and implemented in different states, it's almost like reading a legal contract. And that's really difficult, not just for the tourism industry, but for travelers themselves. You know, the actual clarity to come out of this the other side, to remove all this bureaucracy and go back to that situation that we used to know, where we could literally just book and travel, just book and go. That inhibiting factor is going to be around for quite a long time. And I think for travelers, not just for the travel industry, we've got to be able to get away from this, because nobody really knows at the moment what they can do and where they can go and what they can't do.
Yeah, it's definitely complex. And I think in a country like Thailand, where the mentality has been around zero case, you know, is the goal, even if they're managed to successfully in a relatively short time, 30 days from now, have brought this back under control, it's just going to reinforce the need for, you know, continued extreme diligence a desire not yet to open to foreign markets. So I think the best case scenario for Thailand is they quickly bring this under control and domestic travel can restart in a meaningful way sometime, maybe late second quarter, third and fourth quarter. This is the optimistic scenario I would plan for if I was operating in that market.
Yeah, exactly. It's all about Songkran. See if it can be brought under control by then.
Let's move on to where I am, Indonesia. I think Indonesia, you know, a lot of correlations to what you're seeing in Malaysia. Certainly now we are in an equal or more severe situation than we've been to date in terms of managing the spread of COVID. In some recent days, you know, we're hitting record numbers across different metrics. We've recently, just yesterday, gone into a little bit of an enhanced version of lockdown, restricting movements between territories, a little bit stricter imposition on number of employees who can be in the office. I think now we're at 25% capacity. So those things are all headwinds, you know, for the resumption of domestic travel. I do think that travel executives in Indonesia have largely fully committed to domestic market. You know, it's only domestic, and they've stopped talking about when is something else coming back, with the exception of a few international markets that are already open. So I think they've done a pretty good job of that. But these lockdowns are a challenge. But I think so far, the overall culture hasn't been a zero case culture like Vietnam or Thailand. And Indonesian people are more accepting this as a part of life. You need to practice good safety and hygiene protocols, but you also need to continue to live life. So I'm somewhat concerned about the recent increase in lockdowns, but I'm still very optimistic for domestic market performance full year. So just some positive management of the current crisis with some limited restrictions, hopefully can manage it to acceptable levels. And the overall mentality of Indonesian, both business and leisure travelers, seems to be, hey, I want to live my life as normal, and I'm willing to accept risks and responsibilities to practice safe hygiene in order to do that.
Yeah, I'd say so. I think there's still a lot of potential there. It's such a big domestic market, you know, a bit like China, that they've got all of those people. They've got a really diverse tourism product as well. So there is a big potential. And even, you know, in terms of travel appetite, we've seen Indonesian tour groups traveling overseas, traveling to Turkey, traveling to UAE, because they haven't been banned from outbound travel like some other Southeast Asian countries are. So there is also, you know, even to Saudi Arabia for Umrah. So there is that potential for the Indonesian outbound market to also make a comeback. It's just a matter of other countries allowing Indonesians in.
Yeah, I think selecting these markets that are allowing Indonesian travelers and are benefiting big time. I recently took a flight from here to Dubai, and it was completely full in both directions. And because they're processing large numbers of people, both Jakarta airport out and Dubai airport in, for example, they're getting very good at it. They have good processes, good system for processing large number of people arriving, doing kind of test when you arrive. So the level of sophistication in how they've simplified and streamlined the process around what happens when someone lands and they need a COVID on arrival test is amazing. So using scanners, barcodes to kind of whisk people through the system. I came in during what I would say was a peak period, and I was COVID tested on arrival and out of the airport in 20 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah, that's impressive.
I think that's a good point. There are some key select destinations that are going to benefit from Indonesia outbound, and some key players who are already focused on promoting that as, you know, one of the key places you can reach if you're trying to get out of the country for, in particular, leisure.
What's your instinct about Bali? I've been looking at the 7-day moving average figure in Bali is relatively low now, particularly compared to Jakarta. Do you think they'll be readying Bali to open up sometime soon internationally?
I know I've heard talk about them trying to vaccinate Bali first. I don't really know how that works, and we'll talk about vaccines more later. I think Bali is a fighter for sure, and the industry there is a fighter, and they're going to work as hard as they can to try to open up both to domestic more freely. Now the testing requirements for anyone outside of Bali to get in are quite rigorous, and perhaps causing some reduction in domestic volumes. We are just on the back of the holidays, so you could expect now Bali would be quieter. But I'm a big believer in Bali. It's a great destination. Indonesians who are traveling there actually are loving it that there's not, no offense to Australians, I love you guys, that there's not like a million partying Australians in the middle of Kuta. They're like, wow, it's a whole different place now. Or you go to a temple and there's not, it's not, you know, swamped with mainland Chinese travelers. So that Bali is like actually feels Indonesian again. They love it.
I guess ultimately it comes down to the economic factor though, doesn't it? Is that those big markets, those big inbound markets bring the big bucks and they support the bigger resorts, they support the bigger restaurants, they support the bigger venues. And for those to get back up and running again, they're going to need more support from the international market.
Yeah, I mean, I just think in 2021, it has to be that everybody's talking about, you know, the new now, not the new normal. And everyone needs to go after whatever currently exists. And the domestic tourism market in the next, in my lifetime anyway, won't replace what they had in the international market. So it's going to have to get smaller and going to get focused on the needs of domestic travelers. But it's fourth largest country in the world with the right product, with the right marketing. Could Bali become, you know, a huge destination, you know, four times larger for domestic than it was ever before? For sure. It is a great destination. It was just never optimized for domestic tourism.
Sure.
Let's move on to, speaking of Dubai and doing a, you know, extreme example or a great example of trying to build out how should things work in this environment. Singapore is closely related as an aviation hub. What do you guys see happening in Singapore right now? What do you predict for 2021?
Good question. I mean, I think Singapore is going to lead the way for Southeast Asia. We were talking about its attempts to do travel bubbles. I think 2021 is going to see it continuing to attempt to set up all of these different travel corridors and agreements. But at least by doing that, they're showing Southeast Asia other ones that it is possible to do that. And hopefully if they get one off the ground and it works and it doesn't trigger loads of cases, other countries can follow that. And I think the other interesting thing that Singapore Airlines have started to do is they've started to try to collaborate with IATA for this smart travel pass thing, you know, which is this idea of validating the COVID tests and of ultimately validating vaccinations as well and making it more friction, a more frictionless experience. So it'll be interesting to see if they manage to make that a successful pilot. But there's certainly a lot of complications when you're looking at doing something like this.
Yeah, I mean, I agree with Hannah. We've been saying this on the podcast for the last few months that Singapore, for two things. One, it's always, I think it always has been in Southeast Asia, the most forward-looking destination in terms of the way that it tries to optimize the resources that it has. It has a pretty complex travel industry as well. You know, you said there that it is a, it's an air hub between East and West and around Asia and the Middle East as well. That really behoves it. But it also has a really, really strong MICE, really, really strong business travel, really strong leisure market, very, very, very strong and vibrant cruise market as well. So it's got to bring all those elements back, because just bringing back one or two of those parts of the pie don't really support the whole industry. I think there are two things that really stand in its favor. One, I think it's a trusted destination. I think tourists from some of the bigger markets, probably you would think India, perhaps China, maybe the Middle East, they are going to be looking at trusted destinations, destinations that handled and managed the virus very, very well. Singapore falls squarely into that category. I think from the business travel aspect, you know, it's hosting the World Economic Forum in May. And I think for the whole region, that is a bit of a litmus test to see whether Southeast Asia can hold a really big international event during this time. So I think Singapore has a lot of cards to play. I think it will play them quite carefully. You know, it did, as you said, it opened up a lot of these green lanes and it tried to do the Hong Kong-Singapore travel bubble at the end of last year. It sort of reappraised that during the Northeast Asian winter. But I think come spring, I expect Singapore to be quite aggressive. And I think we'll see some quite enterprising things from them.
I think it'll be difficult for them to, and for Dubai, to build out this concept of being a hub, that the recovery is going to be very bilateral, at least in the early days. It really feels like, okay, people from this market are going to that market versus there becomes a lot of kind of transit traffic. So I think this will be somewhat of a challenge for them becoming a hub, but for them becoming one of the first destinations that some of the large markets go to, this is the play. So yeah, China, India, Indonesia, Malaysia. I think this is the where I would focus if I was in the Singapore government trying to set the policy. I would be squarely focused on those big market opportunities, trying to figure out how I open them. I wouldn't worry about the green lane with Germany or whatever. I mean, sure, Germany's important, no big market, but I would really be focusing in on the top few markets, trying to get them restarted and working at the political level to see what it's going to take to do that. We have 15 minutes left. I want to make sure we get time for the insights. There's two markets we didn't talk about yet. We can give like, you know, 30 seconds per market, you know, Vietnam and Philippines. I'll go first. Vietnam is going to crush it, man. They're going to be the market leader in Southeast Asia in terms of performance for 2021. Indonesia is going to give you guys a close race for your money. But Vietnam is just going to crush it. And on Philippines, wow, you know, this I think one of the most challenging markets for volume in 2021. I would have said for sure the most challenging market, but after the Malaysia announcements today, I think Malaysia is looking equally challenging for 2021. So those are my views for those two markets. Quick thoughts on either Vietnam or Philippines before we get into actionable insights.
Philippines for me, like you say, it's super complicated. Even right now, not all domestic travel is reopened since they closed in March. They're in a mess. And it's this trouble of local governments versus the centralized government. And how do they handle that? Even now with vaccines, local governments are procuring that. It's going to be tricky this year for Philippines.
Yeah, concur with that. Vietnam, I think, is interesting. I think domestic will really scale up. I think one of the interesting things about reopening, let's just remember a little bit that towards the end of this year, Hanoi is supposed to be hosting the Southeast Asia Games, and Vietnam doesn't want anything to get in the way of that actually happening. Last year, if you remember, it was supposed to host the first Formula One Grand Prix in Hanoi. It built this whole brand new racetrack. It was really looking forward to this biggest ever sporting event the country was ever going to host. COVID-19 actually knocked that one out of the ballpark. So I still think that they'll be relatively cautious on inbound openings, but I think the domestic sector will grow fast.
2021, let's talk about a few key actionable insights. I got to start off with something that we've been mentioning the whole time, you know, throughout the podcast, which is vaccinations. So everyone I talk to, including, you know, high-level executives, you know, has this talking point of vaccinations and tracking vaccination progress and, okay, when is it going to help us restart international? But I just don't get it. I got to be honest with you guys. I don't get it. So, you know, I want to ask the question, you know, should travel executives view vaccination as an enabler for their businesses in 2021? Or is it just a false idol? I'm going to go with false idol in 2021.
I'm going direct opposite. Yes, they should consider it. They should consider it very, very strongly, because not just is it an enabler, and there's a question there actually from Stephen Grace about airlines, whether there'll actually be more testing before vaccines are actually rolled out. And that's every chance that we would like to have seen that happen a long time. Hannah and I have been talking about the problems of people turning up with false positives and false negatives. But the vaccine issue is consumer confidence. And I really think that for people to travel overseas, they are going to want to feel vaccinated in large numbers. I just think that's going to have such a big play on the demand side of travel.
Hannah, what do you say?
You know what? I'm somewhere in the middle, I think, between you two. So, yes, you know, yeah, there we go. Right? No, because, yes, everybody is talking about it. And, yes, long term, I think it is going to make a difference. But in the short term, you know, let's say you're a UK citizen and you've just had your second dose of the vaccine. Can you travel to Singapore without quarantine right now? No. Can you go to Thailand without quarantine? No. Can you go to the Philippines without quarantine? No. So it actually makes no difference. And I think until there is some significant data around that, that's going to reassure governments that they can reopen the borders to vaccinations. And then, of course, you've got the whole problem of how do you authenticate these vaccinations? Are different vaccinations worth different things? Is the China one as reliable as if you've got Pfizer, as if you've got AstraZeneca, if you've had the vaccines 1 month apart versus 3 months apart in the UK? It's super complicated.
I mean, exactly. This is why I got to go against Gary. Almost never do. But I got to go against Gary on this. I mean, it seems like it's false idol. So everybody's talking about it. But if you ask any question, you know, with that has you know, some sense of respectability about how this is going to work, everything falls apart. You know, it's like the timeline. So this is a great data set around where we're at with procuring the vaccine, but the timelines already look, you know, like they're getting pushed out, and we haven't even really started pushing it out yet. And exactly who's going to get vaccinated, where, when, and how, still relatively unclear. So that whole process, pretty important, but we don't really know how it's really going to work.
Right. I'm going to throw one back to you here, Brett.
Yeah.
The two biggest markets in our region, the two, we'll come to this in a minute, but the two markets that everybody wants back, India and China, right? Two countries that are producing their own vaccines are going to vaccinate their own populations at the fastest rate probably in the world. So the two biggest markets that may come back in travel will both be heavily vaccinated. I think that's going to have a huge impact on the region and the way people perceive vaccinations.
Fair point. I'm going to give you that. But you know, once they vaccinate their entire population of, I don't know, billions of people in both the markets you mentioned, how long does that, you know, to vaccinate them, does it take? And once somebody gets the vaccine, how long does it last? So if it takes them 6 months to roll out, do they have to like restart as soon as they rolled out? I mean,
it's a really good point. And the science differs. So Sinovac have said at least 6 months for their vaccine. Moderna in the US has said probably a year. So we don't know. I mean, the fact is we don't know. I agree with that. But I think the initial stage of actually getting people on board to actually have a vaccine to be able to travel again, I think once people have had the first one, they won't really too much worry about when it is they have to have their second one. They'll be willing to take it. The science will roll out there. But we've got more vaccines to come as well. I mean, the Johnson & Johnson vaccine is going to be a single vaccine shot. That's going to be a big...
Oh, my God. Steven's coming down against me. Come on, bro. Okay, let me ask some more questions. So how do you verify it? So let's say they rolled it out, everybody's got it, maybe Singapore's vaccinated and India and China. How do they actually verify that you're one of the people who really got vaccinated?
Yeah, this is going to be hard, because even if you look at the Philippines, you look at Boracay right now, they're getting tons of cases where tourists are trying to enter on false RT-PCR tests. And I could imagine that the incentive to falsify vaccination documents is going to be even greater. So you are going to really need some hardcore authentication process, which nobody has really come out with yet. I mean, if you look at yellow fever, it's a physical document, right? Can you do that for this? People are probably going to want to falsify it.
So, Stephen, let's say they solve this problem and IATA becomes, you know, an amazing breakthrough computer. And gets this figured out. Here's how you validate the travel vaccination passport. If you have got vaccinated, do these vaccinations protect you against mutated strains? So we've all heard about, hey, there's this new strain from UK. You know, are you sure that this vaccine is going to protect you from mutated versions of the current virus?
Probably not. I mean, if you look at the Sinovac vaccine, which did clinical trials in Indonesia, the results of its trial effectiveness was about 65%. But when it did that same trial in Turkey and Brazil, the figures were much, much higher. So there's loads of variables here that we really don't know about. But I think the interesting point going back to Stephen's first question and your first question about, you know, whether this is a false idol or whether we're actually kind of putting the cart before the horse here, because vaccine rollouts in most countries, take aside China and India, are going to take quite a long period of time. And Stephen's question is absolutely right. You know, we need to have testing protocols for pre and post-flight testing, because otherwise airlines are going to go bust. They're not going to be able to wait until enough people can travel again. So there has to be an interim period. And, you know, we really need some multilateral agreement on that, which is something we haven't had yet. And, you know, that's frustrating. You see different travel organizations and travel bodies say stuff, they say it well, but they need the science.
On top of Gary's testing, you know, there needs to be, I think, a less invasive, cheaper way of this gold standard testing rather than the RT-PCR test, which does put off travelers from traveling. You know, they're worried that it's going to feel uncomfortable. They don't want the bother of having to go and wait for the results and pay lots of money. I think the industries need to start focusing on that as well as vaccines in tandem, because like Gary said, it's going to be a transition period. This is going to take a while.
All right, I'm going to declare Hannah the official winner of this debate.
In the middle.
Not not quite a false idol, not going to save the world, but somewhere in the middle, there probably is some opportunity there. So Hannah, well done. Move on to your second topic, which is, you know, where is your focus going to be? So you guys are consultants. You're working with people running travel businesses, and they're coming to you saying, hey, you know, what should I do? You must hear this, like, you know, multiple times per week, right? So what is your advice when you're thinking about 2021? What are you telling travel executives in the region to do?
Well, actually, I mean, my advice, and I work with some hotel companies, my advice hasn't actually changed since before the pandemic. You have to look at the consumer trends in China, because that is by far the most forward-thinking, the most aggressive, the most experientially experimental market in the world. Technology is used to a great degree, but do you look at the way that Chinese consumers are indulged in almost every aspect, not just travel, but in the consumption sphere. And you look at the level of service in hotels, on the train systems, on the airlines. And I lived in China at the beginning of the 2000s. It's you know, it's transformed 360 degrees and even more. And I think that the interesting thing about that is not just what's actually happening on the market domestically in China, but that's the expectations that Chinese travelers bring into our region and take around the world. And a lot of those, as we've seen over the past year, a lot of those trends in things like consumer payments, digital payments, e-commerce, technology, all of these things, you know, they're filtering into our region from China. Live streaming is a great example of that. You know, it came from China. It's all across Southeast Asia now. So I think you have to look at the consumer sphere. You have to look at what's happening and what's changed in China, and bring that on board for your service levels in Southeast Asia, because I think it's going to be vital in, as you say, that new now of whatever we're entering.
Let me push you on that a little bit, just to get more specific. I mean, is there one or two kind of travel-related consumer behavior items that you're really focused on when you're trying to be, hey, okay, I want to pay attention to what's happening in China. Where do I start?
I think there are a number of things, but I think what really happened in the Chinese domestic travel sector is it started to grow back again pretty quickly. So there was a lot of competition. So the airlines were dropping their prices, but the hotels really had to compete on experiences, not just staycation. They really had to focus quite intently on their food, the quality of their food experiences, not just the actual delivery of what you serve, but the backstories of the food, the chefs, and that kind of stuff. So they're really looking at high service level, even at the mid-level hotels, not just at the very, very highest level. So I think the indulgence of Chinese consumers, and you go into an online platform in China right now, and the buying experience is so simple. And yet it's very engaging, it's very experiential. You know, you're participating all the way through. So I think, you know, it's no longer about buying and selling, it's about being participative along the whole journey.
All right, so I'm hoping Hannah's gonna bring it together, but I'm gonna have to go against Gary on this topic as well. I mean, so 2021, would I be looking to China for what to do with my travel business? No, you know, I would be looking right down the street. So when I'm talking to travel leaders, you know, I think you should forget about everything international, go hyper-local. And so it's not just about only focus on domestic, but I think you should only focus on domestic, but it's only focus on domestic, but also get very granular on domestic. What, you know, what are the segments? What are the sub segments? What are those, what are the needs of those consumers? And how are you, and are you, and if you are, how are you going to transition your product, your marketing, your pricing, revenue management, you know, every part of your operation to really dial in to the experiences that those customers want. So, you know, Bali's my example. Could Bali be, you know, four times its size as a domestic destination, you know, 3 years from now than it was in 2019? I absolutely think so. You know, it's a great destination for Indonesian domestic travelers. They just have to optimize for that. So that's what I would be going. It's definitely where the opportunities are going to be in 2021. And I think it's also a sustainable approach. Of course, if you become great in the domestic market, that's not going to harm you in the future. You're building also kind of a strong business that can move forward. So Hannah, maybe you can put the divide between Gary and I, or you can just say somebody's name. You can say Gary or Brett. Or you agree with?
I think I'm actually more with Brett on this. I was going to say domestic and niche. And yeah. I think you summed up. Yeah, I mean, I think, yes, Gary's right in that there are really interesting things going on in China, and we often see this filter through to the Southeast Asian market. You know, the same, what's going on in Korea, what's going on in Japan, we see those trends from East Asia come into Southeast Asia eventually. So you should keep an eye on that. But I think, yeah, you really need to know your customers, your local customers, to be able to create a product for them. And like you said, it's not going to harm you. When international people, the travelers start to come in, finally, you can then, you know, turn that product around to suit them as well. So it's not that you're creating something like as a standalone, as a one-off. It's going to help you in the long term as well.
Okay, I want to come back on you. I want to come back on you there, Brett, because I think, while I do agree that the next two quarters will be domestic only, I think we should be prepared to be surprised by India and China. I think they'll be back later in the year, and I think we'll be back bigger and faster than ever.
That is a fair point. I'm gonna go again. I take your last point as much stronger. You're making me concerned. I'm not doing enough to prepare for these giant markets. But I'm gonna go with Hannah for the win again, kind of bridging the, hey, focus on the domestic market, but as you think about reinventing the business, you need to be looking to China for kind of leadership in terms of the traveler experience. And I'll give you like a side asterisk, Gary. Maybe I'm thinking too short term. You gotta be ready for these market giants. And actually it may vary depending on which market you're in. Certainly for Bali, not to be preparing for China opening is probably, you know, getting too focused. But for Bandung hotels, maybe forgetting about China in 2021, okay. Hey, so let's close out with just talking about China and what a big influence it's going to be over the next 12 months as markets race to, win the opening of, you know, China leisure and business travel. So what are your thoughts on both preparing for that, you know, to your point, Gary, as well as where is it most likely to happen and what's going to drive that?
I'd say where it's likely to happen is probably a bit easy. I think Laos, I think Cambodia, maybe Vietnam, like you said, Singapore. I think these, Thailand, not sure.
Why would it be Laos?
Laos, well, they've got a lot of economic ties, and it wouldn't be that they think that Laos is significantly going to contribute to China, but it might be a little bit of a political play. They've got the railway opening between Laos and China slated to open later in the year. So, yeah, I think could be a little thing there. What do you think, Gary?
I think it's pretty hard to predict. Predicting China at any time is really, really hard to predict. I mean, I would say Myanmar. I think Myanmar's got, China said yesterday that it's going to help Myanmar with its vaccine rollout to really push that. So I think Myanmar has every chance of attracting Chinese tourists towards the end of the year. I think Singapore, I would totally agree with. Maldives for sure, possibly Sri Lanka. I think those would be, Dubai, definitely Dubai. I think those would be big markets to look out for from the Chinese market. But yeah, I mean, it really depends on the speed and the scale and where, what it is that Chinese travelers want from their first trip after a year and a half of being locked down. And that will vary. And so, you know, it's going to be really down to marketers to really engage very, very closely and to sell something different to what they sold before. You know, think a little bit differently. We are in a new era. And what is it that you can offer Chinese travelers or Indian travelers or Middle Eastern travelers that's different to what you offered them before? Because, you know, they're going to have a lot of choice. Everybody's going to be coming at them quite hard in terms of marketing, probably going to be dropping prices as well. But you've got to really find something that adds value for that first trip overseas again.
I think especially if you imagine only a few markets open for leisure, it's hard for me to describe. It's kind of like vaccination. When people ask me to drill down on China market opening, how's it going to work? Who's going to come? You don't have any of the answers. So it can be kind of talk like we're just pontificating about a bunch of information. But I definitely think it'll be driven, politically. And politically tied to kind of economic importance. That's why I struggle with some of the markets you're mentioning, like Myanmar and Laos. Yeah. Why even screw with those first? And second, you know, what's the benefit to them of opening their market to kind of travelers from that market?
Laos and Myanmar, they may get preference. They may get exclusivity. They may only open up to Chinese travelers for 3 or 4 months. You know, if they're given the option of a mass vaccine rollout and Laos, they have the chance of you know, the railway is going to open from Yunnan province later this year. They may get exclusivity for a period of the year when nobody else comes in except Chinese travelers. And that brings back the spending power.
Yeah. And if it plays out in that way where only select markets or a single market, or, you know, I think Vietnam will be one of the first, if only a select market or a few markets open, and it really is open, like anyone can go on Ctrip and book a flight to this, and those destinations are going to be able to, you know, really price up. It's only one place they can go for leisure, and it's just going to be swamped. So I think this is also an interesting opportunity that ties to your kind of contention in the second point, prepare. You know, you don't want to be not prepared for that opening, especially if you're in one of these markets, if it's going to go step by step, where travelers can go to.
Yeah, I mean, on that point, the only real destination that I see opening up to a number of countries would be Singapore. I don't really see many of the other countries allowing too many other markets in for the foreseeable future.
All right, with that, we're going to wrap it up. Any closing advice for kind of what are your hopes for 2021?
I'd just like to get on a plane. That would be nice. I've not even been on a domestic flight, so just on a plane. That's my hope.
Like one of those Singapore Airlines flights to nowhere?
No, a real one in the air.
Yeah, same. I'd like to go on a holiday. I love Malaysia, but somewhere outside. I'd love to go back to Sri Lanka.
Well, mine sounds exciting. I'm just really optimistic that we will not get rid of, but we will have collectively a much stronger sense of being able to manage the current COVID crisis. And companies, governments, business, and travel, of course, you know, begins to, with some degree of confidence, rebuild whatever the new now is. So I really feel like we're still in the middle of no man's land. So I'm really optimistic that in thinking this is a long-term issue, that 2021 can be the year we figure it out. And we really are having this conversation at this time next year as we're building out exactly what that is. So Gary Hanna, thanks so much for your time today. Really appreciate that. I'm sure everyone joining today really appreciates learning from you too. All the best for 2021 for both of you individually and also your businesses. If you guys don't follow Southeast Asia Travel Show, please do subscribe. It is the best podcast out there for people looking for, you know, leadership in thought leadership in Southeast Asia travel industry. If you're looking for, you know, top of the food chain consultants in the travel industry, Hanna and Gary are also looking forward to working with you.
Thanks. Brett doesn't get a cut. Thanks, guys.